You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Thursday, August 28th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Patrick Coburn on the return of the jihadis. Also on the program today, the New York Times endorses Tim Wu for lieutenant governor over Andrew Cuomo's running mate, Kathy Hochul. More on the shooting of John Crawford in a Walmart. Another black man shot down by police for holding a toy BB gun in a shopping center. Also, ex-Iowa State Senator, $73,000 to switch his allegiance from Michelle Bachmann to Ron Paul. And who very well may have given him that money may be hugely important in the race for the Senate in Kentucky. Also on the program, Kristen Gillibrand's book apparently discusses the incredible amount of sexism amongst some of her colleagues in the Senate. And labor strikes back, and particularly in Massachusetts. Market basket. Dude. If you haven't, we haven't been following this story terribly much, but I heard about it quite a bit when I would go back to Massachusetts. There was a corporate battle at the head of the Market Basket supermarket chain, a chain of supermarkets in Massachusetts and in New Hampshire, between essentially two cousins. Arthur T. Demoulas and his cousin Arthur S. Demoulas. Arthur T. Demoulas was the longtime president of Market Basket. He was ousted by a group of owners led by Arthur S. Demoulas. And what happened over the past two or three months now has been protests and walkouts by employees and a boycott by customers calling for the reinstatement of Arthur T. Demoulas, because he was just a guy who basically treated his workers fairly. And it apparently has succeeded. Arthur S. Demoulas and his allies agreed to sell their 50.5% stake in the company to Arthur T. Demoulas and his allies, who own 49.5%. According to the statement, the price was more than $1.6 billion. The chain apparently is valued now at $3.2 billion. There's huge celebrations. I cannot overstate how much of a story this has been in Massachusetts and how broadly, you know, we see this coalition between labor and customers. More of this, please. All right, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Patrick Coburn. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. The Middle East correspondent for The Independent UK, Patrick Coburn. and the author of a forthcoming book, The Jihadis Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. Welcome to the program, Patrick.
Thank you.
So I've been reading on your dispatches over the past, particularly over the past 6 months, and it has been stunning to see what has taken place and how quickly ISIS has emerged as an incredibly powerful force. Let's go back, if we could, to sort of retell how ISIS has emerged so strongly and out of the at least I guess primarily from the Syrian conflict. Let's use as a point of departure. Recently, former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that the U.S. was wrong in not supporting radical elements of the Syrian rebellion. I mean, give us your sense if that is the case and how ISIS developed in Syria.
Yes. I think what Hillary Clinton said is politics. It's U.S. politics. It doesn't really have much to do with real events on the ground in Syria and Iraq. ISIS developed. It developed fast, but it didn't come from nowhere. It originally came out of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the group which was founded by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, fought the U.S., in 2004 to about 2009, had become weaker. What relaunched it was really two things. In Iraq, the Sunni minority, about 20% of Iraqis, there are about 33 million Iraqis, and so a fifth of them are Sunni Arabs, felt with reason that they were persecuted, they were marginalized. This was the community that used to effectively run Iraq under Saddam Hussein. But particularly since 2010, their young men were being arrested, tortured, forced into confessions. They couldn't get jobs. Their cities were treated as occupied territory. Then we had the Sunni uprising in Syria, and then that destabilized Iraq in turn. This is where ISIS gained military experience. And now it's been very effectively been able to flip between attacking in Iraq and attacking in Syria. I think what Hillary Clinton was saying really doesn't make any sense. There is an idea that somehow if the administration had supported moderate Syrian opposition, military opposition, this moderate military opposition is very difficult to find on the map. It's the jihadis who've been dominating it for the last 2 years.
And so, I mean, in Syria, and I want to get to the military expertise of ISIS because their achievements have been, it appears, rather stunning. But before we get there, in Syria, who were backing the various players in the Syrian rebellion?
Well, you had backing from Saudi Arabia and the absolute monarchies of the Gulf, Kuwait and United Arab Emirates and Qatar. They backed rebels who belonged to the Sunni a variant of Islam. The Saudis and the others particularly backed those who were jihadis, the very opposite of the secular Democrats. Turkey was also kept the border open, which was very important for the rebellion. Again, they supported the Islamists. So I think that this gave a sectarian tinge to the uprising. And one very important factor is that the main support, financial support from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, these are absolute monarchies. They're almost the only absolute monarchies left on Earth. And in the case of Saudi Arabia, it's a theocratic absolute monarchy. They have their own variant of Islam, Wahhabism, which is very fundamentalist, very sectarian, very anti-Christian, anti-Jewish, anti-Shia, very intolerant. Outside, you had the West, the US, the Europeans. You had a whole gamut of people. And what did they want? Well, I think, and I think this was very blameworthy, they wanted Assad to move aside. They didn't want negotiations on anything else. But Assad has never held less than 13 out of 14 of the provincial capital of Syria, the 14 in total. He's only lost one. He was never going to move aside just like that. By so making that the only reason for negotiation, in fact, they provided a recipe for the war going on and on.
And to what extent, I mean, do we know that there was Western support for any of the rebel groups? Was it significant in terms of arms or money?
That was absolutely crucial. Yeah. Money was coming from Qatar in very large quantities to these groups, really from 2011 on. Volunteers were coming from Saudi Arabia, from North Africa, from Libya, from Morocco. A lot of the ISIS volunteers come from outside the country. And this required also the cooperation of Turkey, because they'd come across the Turkish border. Turkey has a 550-mile common border with Syria.
And did the West, I mean, how much involvement was there from the West, aside from basically saying the terms, creating sort of the parameters to resolve this conflict in a very narrow way? How much money or support came from the United States, from European governments?
I don't think much money came from the U.S., though, you know, initially they were monitoring and orchestrating the delivery of supplies from Qatar to Turkey, which then went to the opposition. So they certainly knew all about it and were hand in glove with the others. It's a little unclear what they were doing in Libya. There was a big channel of Libyan jihadis again going to Turkey and going into Syria, but again they seem to have known all about it. I think that they miscalculated. I think that they thought that Assad was going to go down the same way that Gaddafi did in 2011. The opposition thought the same thing, but now they tend to run history backwards and say, with a few more guns, the opposition say this, we could have taken over. This was never true. I was all over Syria at that time. They had strength, but they didn't have overwhelming strength. This is a genuine civil war.
And so ISIS develops their strength in Syria. You know, at the beginning of the summer, and you address this in I think some of the excerpts I've read from your forthcoming book, that there was a sense that the Sunnis in Iraq, who had either more or less acquiesced to ISIS or were tacitly supporting them and were prepared to throw them over once Maliki was gone. Give me your sense as to the accuracy of those perceptions at the beginning of the summer and where that stands now.
Yes, it's an important question, this. I mean, one explanation that was given when ISIS suddenly took Mosul on the 10th of June and swept through northern and western Iraq was that they were simply the shock troops of the Sunni community, 5 or 6 million people, and that once the current prime minister of Iraq, Nouri al-Maliki, whom they were the hate figure for the Sunni, was gone, that they, once a deal was offered, that they were no longer persecuted, that they would have regional rights, then the Sunni community would throw over ISIS. I never believed in this theory. First of all, when you have a group as ferocious, as cruel, and as paranoid as ISIS, you know, they don't get just stabbed in the back like that. You try to do anything to them, they'll strike first. And we can see that in the course of this year. One tribe in eastern Syria, which opposed them, they simply slaughtered them. They killed at least 700 of them and just took them off the streets of their towns and shot them dead. They've similarly in Mosul, the city of 2 million people in northern Iraq that they captured. There are about sort of 300 local leaders, military leaders who might have acted against them. They've arrested them. Nobody knows where they are. They may be alive. They may be dead. So I think they'll be very difficult to get rid of.
And so one of the things that has also struck me and others, I guess, and you touched on it briefly, is there seems to be a tremendous amount. I mean, now they are holding an enormous amount of territory. They seem to be incredibly organized in terms of an internal bureaucracy, and they also seem to have a tremendous military acumen. What accounts for that?
I think there are two things that account for it. I mean, first of all, you have this chilling combination, as you just mentioned, of extreme religious fanaticism combined with a military competence. Where does the latter come from? I think that there are some trained officers who came from Saddam Hussein's security forces. I think they play a role. I think also there's a very simple thing that people may underestimate, that these people were fighting the U.S. 7 or 8 years ago, and then they were fighting in Syria. And so they have a lot of military experience. And if you survived all that, you're probably pretty good at your job.
Right. And where of the sort of the bureaucracy? I mean, there's a piece in the New York Times today, which outlines their sort of the bureaucratic structure, and it seems pretty sophisticated. Which is I don't know. Am I right to be sort of surprised by that?
Well, I think so. I mean, it was surprising when it happened, but I think it's a consequence of these guys having been in business for quite some time and having survived, that they do have sort of command and control over their people. I think that, but it maybe one shouldn't focus solely on that. They have another thing going for them, which is they've been victorious. You know, for an army, that's vastly important. It's vastly important for their relations with the Sunni community that they've always won. They've won a series of stunning victories. The Iraqi army had 350,000 men in it. I think they'd spent about $42 billion in the last 3 years on the army. Yet it simply disintegrated when it was attacked by a few thousand of these people. Now, mainly that's shows how dysfunctional the Iraqi army is. But it also shows that they were pretty good. And, of course, they're also very good at terrifying their enemies by use of social media, by these horrific sort of snuff movies that they produce, showing themselves executing Shia troops. They're wholly sectarian and bigoted. And, of course, for an army with uncertain morale, like the Iraqi army, a lot of its soldiers think, well, if that's going to happen to me, you know, I'm going to run away before they get close to me, or at least I'm not even going to go back to the army from my home. So that's been pretty effective. I mean, they've been very good at provoking and manipulating terror as if they were some sort of modern Mongol army.
What also strikes me as being somewhat unique in terms of this group, I guess, if you call it, or army now, is the massive amounts of money they have, and the sort of the diversification of sources. Can you speak to that? Because it seems to me in the past that when we have seen these type of jihadi groups, that their money is either been, I think, in the case of Al Qaeda in Afghanistan, a function of the illicit drug trade, and you know that's not necessarily an easy source of money, I guess. I mean, relatively speaking, or they've had a patron who could theoretically turn off the spigot. The ISIS seems now to be sort of self-sustaining in terms of generating cash.
Yes, it's always, I think, been less dependent on outside donors than some of the other jihadis that were all paid by the Saudis or the Gulf and by private donations. In Mosul, they were powerful enough to levy protection money, a sort of tax, even before they took over the city. I know I was talking to one Turkish businessman who had a big construction contract there. He was telling me he had to pay them $500,000 a month. Wow. to stay in business. This was before they took over. Now, of course, they've got a sort of state. You know, it's big. It's, you know, it's bigger than the state of Michigan. It's and they can levy taxes, and they can levy a charge on every truck that goes through their area. They also control oil wells in eastern Syria. They control most of the oil wells there, and some in Iraq. And you can sell off the crude from that through brokers. I mean, you won't get anything like a market price, but if you can produce crude, you know, there's somebody who will buy it, and then it will either be refined in sort of back street sort of distilleries and sold cheap in Turkey, or it'll go even to Syrian government refineries. The brokers will sell to them. So they can make a pretty steady income from that. So it's pretty self-sustaining now. In the past, Saudi donations and Kuwaiti donations played a big role, but I think less so now.
Tell me of the role of Iran in all this. I mean, they are they're clearly ISIS is they perceive ISIS as their enemy, but they've been. I mean, it's what are they doing in this mix? I mean, are they? There's been talk that they were sending troops to Iraq. It's unclear if that actually happened. I mean, what can you tell us on that in that regard?
Well, the dilemma is curiously like that of the U.S. that they don't want to send actual combat troops to Iraq. They're involved in Iran. I mean, this is partly a sectarian war, Sunni against Shia, Sunni led by Saudi Arabia, Shia led by Iran. It's partly a conflict, a long-running conflict between Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies in Iran. It's been going on since the fall of the Shah in 1979. Iran became the predominant influence in Iraq, foreign influence, as the U.S. left. They want to keep a Shia-dominated government there. They're also pretty worried because ISIS, because the Islamic State, Iran used to be fighting them and opposing them in Syria, but now These guys are fighting in towns that are 20 miles from the Iranian border. So they're very worried. A lot of people who don't normally like each other very much have come together because they're frightened of ISIS. They may not have moved that far, but in the U.S. and Iran are on a somewhat parallel course, so they have a common enemy at the moment. What are the Iranians going to do? Well, they are trying to reorganize the militias and of Iraq. But I think they want to stop ISIS, but somewhat similar to the U.S., they don't want to be drawn into an Iraqi or a Syrian quagmire with troops on the ground that are going to suffer heavy casualties.
And what can we expect of the Kurds at this point? I mean, they're clearly trying to defend territory, particularly Kirkuk, that they have now gained control over. To what extent will they be satisfied with simply protecting their boundaries, and I guess as part of their seeking an independent Kurdistan?
Well, they want to. They've always in the past at various moments been allied to the U.S. They're closer than the other Iraqi community or Syrian community to the U.S. So they're looking for air support from the U.S. The Kurds took the opportunity of the fall of Mosul to move into areas they disputed with Baghdad, Kurdish Arab areas, disputed territory. They've taken that over, but it's sort of difficult to defend. It's a 600-mile border. And so I think that they were frightened when ISIS attacked them in recent weeks, and their own troops, whom they'd previously been pretty contemptuous of the Iraqi army running away from ISIS, but their own troops didn't fight too hard initially either. What are the Kurds going to do? Well, they have a quasi-state in northern Iraq. They have, there are Kurds, 10% of the Syrian population are Kurds. They are fighting ISIS as well. This is one of the, in Syria and Iraq, you have a series of different struggles and confrontations going on. One of them is the Kurds creating their own states. The Kurds, who are the people who are left out, left without a country as the Ottoman Empire broke up. And they're looking to create that country now, but they're not united, but they're pretty powerful. And why that's one of the engines of this crisis. I mean, curiously, the U.S. is in a position in Syria now. In Iraq, the U.S. Backs the Baghdad government and the Iraqi Kurds against ISIS. But in Syria, it has this very peculiar policy that it's against ISIS, but it's also against the main opponent of ISIS, which is the Damascus government of Assad. And it also is against the Syrian Kurds, who belong ultimately to a movement called the PKK, which is down as a terrorist organization in the eyes of the U.S. and European governments, although it is the most effective group in fighting ISIS. So, it's a tremendous mess, and we still haven't seen what the outcome will be.
Well, what do you anticipate? I mean, Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel is saying that is certainly talking about ISIS as being a threat that we haven't seen before, for what that's worth. How do you think the United States and the West reconciles that conflict where they are fighting ISIS in Iraq, supporting the Kurds in, I guess, Iraq, technically speaking? They're not quite doing the opposite in Syria, but pretty darn close. I mean, how do they reconcile that? What do you anticipate would be the United States' next move?
It's difficult to predict because, they're looking, no government anywhere likes to get up and say, we're performing a U-turn. Sorry, ladies and gentlemen, we got it all wrong. But I think that there will be something of a U-turn. this, I think, will be partly covert because they have a common interest with the Assad government in opposing ISIS. Now, of course, they're saying, aha, we're not going to ally ourselves with Assad, but nobody's quite expecting that. But, you know, this is a very concrete question now because ISIS is still expanding. It's advancing west. It's very close to 30 miles from Aleppo, the biggest city in Syria. It is taking over from the remains of the rest of the Syrian opposition. It's inflicted a series of defeats on the Syrian army over the last 3 weeks or so. And so at a certain point, the U.S. government may have to ask itself, you know, would we like to see the Assad government dominant in Aleppo, or would we like, will we accept that ISIS is going to take it? And at that point, they have to decide. You know, they can have one or the other. We're not quite there yet, but we're very close to it. So at that point, we'll see. You mentioned this New York Times article this morning. I think it didn't quite see how immediate the threat is. And, you know, all these generalizations that people are going in for at the moment don't really cover the facts on the ground. It, you know, one way it's very simple. If ISIS continues to advance west and inflict defeats on the rest of the Syrian opposition and on the Assad government, then it will have to intervene what effectively is on the side of Assad.
And you know, there was in one of your pieces, you mentioned the fact that as of June, there was probably around 10,000 ISIS fighters. And there was, in talking, I think it was to an Iraqi official, they had basically an algorithm as to how fastly it was expanding. I mean, can you retell that to us and give us a sense of what your sense is that how many ISIS fighters are we talking about now?
Yeah, a very good point. I mean, you'll see figures quoted sort of 10, 15,000. I think it's much bigger, actually. I think it's growing very fast. An Iraqi official for their national security agency told me they'd done a study which showed that where ISIS took over an area with, let's say, 100 fighters, that very soon they would recruit another 500 or 1,000 fighters, i.e. they'd go up, their numbers would increase by a factor between 5 and 10. Now, if that is happening all over the parts of Syria and Iraq that they've captured, which, you know, is a population of 5, 6 million or so, then it's recruiting a lot of fighters. And that seems to be the case on the ground. I mean, they're fighting in towns in Diyala province, a province just northeast of Baghdad. They're fighting right across a big portion of the Middle East, near Aleppo and in eastern Syria. They already hold about 35-40% of Syria, and they hold between a quarter and a third of western and northern Iraq. So I think there are many more fighters like that.
Is there a number? I mean, according to that algorithm, right? I mean, we're talking about what could be anywhere from, I guess, 40, 50 to 100,000 fighters. Is that, I mean, is...
Yeah, I think that they, I think that's not unrealistic. They may not be quite there yet, but I think they quite soon will. And they have money. You have to pay these people. I mean, like any army, these guys, you know, require money, maybe $400, $500 a month. So it's going to cost them a lot of money. They're also incorporating other opposition elements in Syria. I mean, the remains of the opposition is either disintegrating or it's waiting to be attacked, or it's joining ISIS. So you have movements which are already organized with armed and experienced fighters who are simply joining up en masse. for a lot of sort of sunny young men, you know, in these areas, joining a victorious army has a lot going for it. And I think that that's true of the Sunni as a whole in Iraq and Syria. But they may not like ISIS, but on the other hand, it's sort of on their side.
And it seems money. Wins. It seems the money is also a big issue. I mean, my understanding is that they took over the central bank in the Mosul region and something to the tune of $400 million. Is that consistent with your reporting?
I've seen that said. I've never seen that proved. I mean, I know Mosul quite well. I just kind of doubt that they'd have that sort of money, you know, in the vaults.
Uh-huh.
I think that the money more likely, you know, it comes from oil. It comes from, you know, as you said earlier, they have a proper sort of administration organized whereby they can tax people. They can loot stuff from enemies who they force to flee, Christians, Yazidis, other people. They can sell oil and so forth. So I think those are their prime money-making ventures, much like any normal state. You know, most states, right, you know, tax fuel. They tax individuals and businesses. That's how ISIS operates.
And now that al-Maliki is all but out of the picture, and al-Abati is the has been installed or is about to be installed in Baghdad, will this have any implications beyond perhaps a less reluctance by the United States to get more involved?
Well, this is kind of a bet by the U.S. and other outsiders that getting rid of Maliki as prime minister will change things, that he'll be able to produce. They keep Obama and company keep saying, you know, we need an inclusive government, which would include the Sunni, so it could cut the ground from under the feet of ISIS. There's probably something in this, but there may not be enough that the Sunni, first of all, ISIS itself is not ready for a deal. It's not kind of an organization that does deals. It kills its enemy. You know, this is an organization which fights, that it's wholly bigoted. I mean, it's what a friend of mine in Afghanistan calls holy fascists. So they're not looking for a deal. The Sunni community may not be looking for the sort of deal that the Shia would give them. So I'm not sure how much is going to change things in opening the door to the Sunni. I mean, the problem is that maybe a couple of years back, the Shia could have offered to share power more fully with the Sunni. But the Sunni have now taken over their provinces. So, you know, you're offering to share something that the people who don't like you have already taken. That's not a great bargaining position.
Right.
The second thing that's very important is, you know, it's pretty amazing what happened in Iraq. I mentioned there are 350,000 soldiers. There were 650,000 police. These are mainly jobs for the boys, but you know, it all collapsed. Now, can you put together a proper army that will fight? It's not only that we had the fall of Mosul, we had the fall of northern and western Iraq to ISIS, but this government, which has a revenue of $100 billion a year from oil, hasn't been able to put in a single effective counterattack. It hasn't been able to reorganize its army. Now, can a new leadership do this? So we haven't seen that yet. You know, and it's been the weeks are going by. And that's another very important factor, that this government is not a new effective government has not been created so far in Baghdad.
As we wind down here, I mean, how seriously should we take the threat that ISIS, or I should say the claims that ISIS is a threat to American homeland, the American interests, Western interests, the West specifically. In other words, at what stage does ISIS begin to go outside of the boundaries of their battlefield now?
Well, they're kind of doing that by the day. I mean, these are very dangerous people. You know, the caliphate they've created is expanding. It's not contracting. It's not even, people were thinking, well, it gets to a certain stage, they won't, they'll be too spread out, but that's not happening. Is it a threat? Oh, yes, it is, because, you know, as poor James Foley, the American journalist who was murdered by them recently, as that incident showed, when you do something to ISIS, they strike back. The U.S. airstrikes near the Mosul Dam in support of Kurdish soldiers, you know, gave a small victory to the Kurds. ISIS didn't like that, so they kind of trumped that by then very publicly executing an American. Now, the U.S. does something else to them. They'll strike back, not necessarily in, you know, the heart of New York or Chicago or something, but there are U.S. interests all over the world. Right. You know, there are U.S. allies like Turkey. You know, what they've shown is that if you touch them, do anything to oppose their interests, they'll strike back. So the answer to your question is yes, it is a threat to America or anybody else who gets in their way.
And lastly, was this all on some level preordained? When we invaded and occupied Iraq in 2003. In other words, is there a legitimate counterfactual that this could have all worked out better?
People say that now. I think it was. Would have been very difficult. I think there were a couple of things that happened in 2003 that maybe people don't quite take on board. You had people put the invasion and the occupation together. It might have been just if the U.S. and its allies had simply invaded Iraq, overthrown Saddam, and then got out and not occupied it, that the situation would have been better. But they did occupy Iraq and dissolve the Iraqi army. They became the great power in Iraq for a period. That was significant. I think, again, Iraq was stabilizing in 2011 at the time the U.S., just before the U.S. soldiers finally, the last U.S. soldiers left. But what destabilized it was the uprising in Syria and the fact that this uprising was supported by the Sunni state, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey, that had never accepted the Shia.
Modern technology, talking.
ISIS has a much more advanced Skype system, I've read. This isn't a problem for them.
Patrick?
Hello again.
Hi, sorry about that. We lost
Some
you there.
Some gremlin attacked us there.
Yes, indeed. I'm sorry. So we lost you as you were as you were talking about the chances that that perhaps had there been no occupation and that things might have been different.
Yeah, if there'd been no occupation, things might have been different. But Iraq was. Largely restabilized itself. It wasn't a great place in 2011, 2010 when the U.S. left, but there's no doubt the Baghdad government and the Kurds controlled things. What really destabilized it was what happened in Syria, that you had this uprising originally against a dictatorship, but it was very rapidly became a Sunni uprising supported by Sunni states, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, that didn't want a non-Sunni government in Damascus and didn't really accept a Shia government in Baghdad. And that reignited the civil war in Iraq, as Iraqi politicians said it would. I mean, they were all along, I remember them warning me, if this goes on in Syria, this will destabilize us. I think that was the big error of the U.S. and its allies, was not to try harder to close down the war in Syria. it's been pretty obvious the last 2 years that Assad was not going to fall. But they somehow thought that they should continue the war to weaken him, and didn't try hard to close it down. Now, it's all got a bit too late. But they did, this created the circumstances in which ISIS was created. ISIS, this type of fanatical, brutal, military organization only comes out of a war. It doesn't arise naturally in peacetime. But so I think it was the policy in Syria that was most immediately responsible for its rise.
And it seems as if essentially the Iraq was almost the analogy I would use is almost, you know, as if a forest had gone through an extended drought, that it was just simply waiting for a spark that would have all of this, I guess, potential kindling just catch on fire.
Yeah, I mean, Iraq is like that. That's why it's such a dangerous place, because there are three big communities there, the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds, who don't much like each other. Each of them can be sort of ignited if it gets enough foreign support and if it's persecuted by the, another community. So, yeah, the analogy is true. But it wouldn't necessarily have happened. I mean, if I don't think it would have happened if it hadn't been this explosion in Syria. Iraq is 20% Sunni. Syria is about 60% plus Sunni Arab. So ISIS and Sunni organizations have a better constituency from their point of view in Syria than they do in Iraq. You know, it seems to me this is pretty obvious. I don't quite see why people in Washington and Europe didn't see this a bit more clearly. I think it was a massive mistake on their part. Of course, on the part of the Saudis and the Gulf monarchies and Turkey, they did see this. But, you know, these are hardcore Sunni states, and they're fighting a sectarian war, a sectarian confrontation with the Shia and with Iran. And so they were always going to try and push Assad out of power. I think presenting it as sort of a democratic opposition, secular opposition against a dictatorship in Damascus was very simple-minded. It's a very bad, nasty government in Damascus. It's a it's an autocracy. It's extremely violent. But I think the presentation by Western governments and indeed by the media of the rebels as sort of secular Democrats was always nonsense, that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies would not have been supporting them if they were that way inclined.
And so just to be lastly, just to be clear, so from your perspective, the mistake that was made was essentially from the West, and it would be to not have to have not recognized that, in fact, Assad was not going anywhere, and they should have sought to end this conflict in a way that would have recognized that reality and sought some type of negotiated situation which would have ultimately left Assad in power because there was no other option.
That's correct, yeah, to bring the war to an end. It's perfectly reasonable for them to say, well, look, you know, there must be some form of power sharing in Damascus, but to try to make as a the only thing worth talking about is Assad going. When Assad controls all the main cities and much of Syria, then, you know, this was never going to happen. So however this was presented, in fact, this was a recipe for keeping the war going. And this created the conditions in which ISIS grew. I mean, I remember talking at the end of 2012 to one senior diplomat, a British diplomat, and he was saying, oh, I think this business about the war in Syria spreading is much exaggerated. You know, he was dead wrong. But, I mean, it wasn't just Britain alone. It was America and other countries that thought the same way.
Patrick Coburn, the book is The Jihadis Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
All right, folks, we're going to head into the funner half in a moment. That, I mean, it's it. I mean, imagine if a year ago or 2 years ago, the U.S. administration and the West had basically said we're just going to come to a settlement with Assad, or we're going to try and broker a situation where Assad ends up staying. I mean, it's almost impossible to imagine from a domestic standpoint, or even from a sense of how that would look to the rest of, I guess, the Arab pro-democracy movements,
there were
reform
so,
movements.
There were so many Middle Eastern, you know, dictators or leaders being overthrown at that time. I can't imagine, you know, if they just said, okay, this one can stay. You know what I mean?
No, there was a sharp distinction, though, I think. I mean, the first couple of months of what was happening in Syria was like you're saying. I mean, it really was very analogous to everything else that was happening in the region at that time. And it included a lot of different people. It included liberal and secularist and social. There's anarchist movements in Syria. But I guess I think the big difference he was saying that was true between Libya and Syria as an example is that the Assad regime really does have support. And there is a base for it. It's not just like this kind of shallow thing that once you push that, the whole thing would come tumbling down in a certain sense.
And I guess the question is, at what point over the course of those 2 or 3 years was there space to basically say we're going to intervene, but in a way that will ultimately leave Assad in power?
Well, what's really disturbing, though, is that this is what he's always basically said was going to happen himself. And I think he did facilitate
Assad.
This happening. Assad said that. He said from the very beginning, including when it was just nonviolent protests and uprising, that these are all Islamic terrorists. And in fact, he released Islamic terrorists from prisons and, you know, was very conscious. And the notion was, is at some point
to make the rebellion,
he wanted to pick his rebellion.
Right.
And he got the rebellion he wanted. And, you know, I think it is important to not lose sight of just really how obscene that government is. But, you know, things have turned out as he wanted them.
We
to
will be
out.
Bombing in Syria. I don't know when that's going to happen, but it seems to me now that it's there's a certain inevitability to this that we will end up. I mean, you know,
a year later with a different strategy. It's like, yeah, we're not going to bomb Syria in the way we were, but we're still going to bomb Syria.
That's right, right. This time we're just going to shift where the bombs, you know, or the general vicinity where the bombs land. And again, you know, this is a function of 2003, and the one thing that dooms American foreign policy is the inability for, it seems to me, policymakers, but also the public and the media, is to actually sort of conceptually get their hands around the idea that when you're talking about these broad geopolitical questions, an action you take at one time really will ripple through for years and years to come. I mean, you would think we would just get the idea just from like, hey, we're still dealing with the implications of Pico Sykes, right? Or
I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
And the idea that it's so hard for our body politic to accept that, like, wow, that mistake we made in 2003 really was a big, big mistake. And, you know, you drop a rock in a very long pool And the ripples are just going to keep going until they hit something.
Well, in this case, you're hitting a region where things are already coming to a head regardless.
Yeah, I mean, a huge mess.
But how do you get to a point where you're aware of all of that and then also know that, like, ISIS does kind of present something new? And it does need to be addressed in a certain way. I really don't know what the smartest way to address it is, but you cannot say, like, with the Taliban, they're going to do some really horrific things. They don't, maybe in Pakistan that's a little different, but in Afghanistan they do not present a threat to us per se, and you got to just kind of back off of it. This is different. This really could absolutely present a very different type of threat. Sooner than anybody could realize.
I don't know. I don't know. I am glad I am not in charge of making that decision. But it is.
You're like, this is where I duck out and go back to the Social Security meeting.
Right. Exactly.
Good luck, everybody.
Exactly. Next week on the Majority Report, a rundown of the Emmys, and. Out of control. Then meanwhile,
Louis robbed. Yeah. Medicare good. ISIS no idea. I'm Sam Cedar.
Indeed. I'm just flummoxed by this. It is just, you know, the Humpty Dumpty. And I used to say this back in 07 and 08 and 06 and 05 and 04. Humpty Dumpty got pushed off the wall. And I don't know how you put it back together again. That's not staying completely consistent with the Humpty Dumpty metaphor, but I don't know how you put it back together.
I was going to say that.
So with that said,
disturbed by how cavalier.
What a great summer it's been. Man. All right. Let's take a break. 646-257-3920. Folks, it is your support that makes this show possible. So if you have the financial means, please become a member today at majority.fm. You will enable us to continue to do this show on a daily basis. We got a lot of stuff coming up. I mean, as if – let's just get back to, those more mundane problems of the right wing turning this country into a regressive nightmare and
the less fit ISIS.
Right. I mean, I'm reading all the models now saying Senate takeover by Republicans. I don't know. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number if you want to be a part of this program. Also, if you want to support this program without having to spend any money that you wouldn't otherwise, there's always MajorityReportKickback.com. MajorityReportKickback.com. If you buy crap from Amazon, there's no way you can look yourself in the mirror and say the words, I am not buying it through the Majority Report link. All you got to do, go to MajorityReportKickback.com, click on the link, bookmark it. You never have to do another thing. You just buy your Amazon crap through there. We get a kickback. Or, I barely buy anything on Amazon, but today I'm going to buy a rototiller because probably they're on sale since we're at the end of the season. And you go to MajorityReportKickback.com. You click on the Amazon link. It takes you to Amazon. I don't know. You search rototiller. You buy a rototiller. We get a little kickback. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Buy the Majority Report blend. Tweet to Just Coffee if you drink their coffee. And tell them it was the Majority Report that turned you on to them. All right, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920. I forgot to put on the IM. I'll put it on now. We'll be right back after this.
I give her my love, she says no. She says no, 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 no. 'Cause you're only a friend to me. Only a brother to me. She's a pretty little dog who says no. She knows I love her so. If I ask her to walk with me, she shakes her head at me. She's a pretty little doll who says no. Ask her to walk with me. Why can't she ever see? Says you're only